I am far more concerned than what's happening at the editorial page by what's happening in news pages.
Molly Hemingway speaking at this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case conference.
In news pages, that old idea that we had for a few decades of aiming toward objectivity has just been completely thrown out the window.
And this is a generalization, but I think it bears out. And again, I mean, even 5-10 years ago, it would have sounded crazy that I'd be saying this, but I mean, I think it is the case. You have to view the explicit goal of most of the major journalistic institutions in this country as electing Democrats. And when they aren't electing Democrats, they're trying to push the Democratic Party further left.
You can watch and listen to a recording of journalists Mark and Molly Hemingway's Q&A from our 2020 Making the Case conference. It's available in both video and audio formats for a tax-deductible contribution of $250. Learn more at issuesetc.org. It's become common parlance now, the term systemic racism. We hear it from our politicians, from protesters, from everyone across the political spectrum. It seems to be a foregone conclusion. When I first heard this, I heard systematic racism. And I thought, well, okay, that makes sense. There are certain institutions into which have been built maybe some racist presuppositions, or maybe there are people out there who actually have influence legally or academically who have racist ideas. There are certainly individual people who act and think in racist ways, but that's not what systemic racism is about. It's not about a legal or an individual or even an institutional form of racism. It's more like reality is racist. If you're born to the oppressing class, you're an oppressor regardless of what you think or say, or do, and that makes you part of the problem. Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're going to talk about systemic race theory. Dr. Matthew Frank joins us. He's Associate Director of the James Madison Program and Lecturer in Politics at Princeton University, Senior Fellow at the Witherspoon Institute, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Radford University and Contributing Editor to Public Discourse, and an author of a recent column titled "Racism is Real, but is Systemic Racism?" Dr. Frank, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Glad to be with you.
Many today argue that if one does not accept the idea of systemic racism, one is denying that racism itself exists. How do you respond to that?
I think that that's a mistake. Racism is a sin for us Christians, those of us who are Christians. It's a vice. It's a moral wrong. Certainly acting on racist thoughts or feelings or absurd notions of one race's superiority and another's inferiority is an injustice. I certainly affirm that racism exists and that it is a grievous wrong. The argument I was making in my article the other day was that systemic racism is something of a myth, a theory about the shape and character of the whole of our society that suggests that there's just a kind of inbuilt or inherited racism in the system of American life or the structures of our institutions and our culture that no one actually has any personal agency for, that no one is guilty of, but that we're all somehow, or at least all of us, people who are not persons of color, white people in particular, something that we're all complicit in, even if there's nothing in particular that any of us did or are responsible for or could do anything to change.
Tell us about the on-again, off-again publication of your essay on systemic racism for Newsweek.
I took this draft op-ed of mine on the idea that systemic racism is a curious kind of myth or even an odd conspiracy theory, something we can come back to. I took it to Newsweek because they had published some interesting stuff. There's a young conservative opinion editor there. I don't think he'll mind my mentioning his name, Josh Hammer. Josh is diversifying the opinion page at the Newsweek website and doing a really great job. He had recently published a piece by a colleague of mine in the math department at Princeton, Sergio Kleinerman. Professor Kleinerman, a distinguished mathematician, had challenged the president of Princeton, who recently said that there's systemic racism here. to show the evidence where, you know, I don't see it, he said, and he compellingly argued that Princeton was not a racist institution, which is frankly something I think the president ought to be arguing. He ought to be defending his own institution. He's been president for years now. So I thought, oh, Newsweek will be a good venue. And I worked with Mr. Hammer and an assistant to him shaping the piece up last Friday. They published it Monday morning. And then about 2 hours later, it was actually taken down. I subsequently discovered that the editor-in-chief, a woman named Nancy Cooper, had taken the piece down. I subsequently had a conversation with her on the phone, and I agreed not to divulge the contents of that whole conversation. But the one thing that I can say was that she thought the piece would be better used as part of a feature they have at Newsweek called The Debate, in which it would be set off against a piece taking the opposing point of view. It would be delayed by a week to do that. In the meantime, Newsweek had published no explanation of why a piece that appeared on its website had been taken down 2 hours later. Lots of folks on social media were saying, oh, it must have been really terrible. They were embarrassed. They realized they shouldn't have published it in the first place. And, you know, if it had appeared a week later, set next to a piece I never got a chance to look at in advance that responded to me, that impression would be reinforced, that they thought, you know, that this conservative view, just we can't put it in front of our readers without placing it directly next to a piece that says it's wrong. So I said, look, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to let you have the piece now to repost in under those conditions. And I took it to the publication where, as you mentioned at the top, I'm a contributing editor, Public Discourse, published by the Witherspoon Institute, edited by my good friend Ryan Anderson. Ryan agreed to publish it. Ryan and Serena Sigalito, the editors of Public Discourse, agreed to publish it. And I attached a preface to it that explained its fate at Newsweek. It kind of went viral after that, which I think is why I'm talking to you. But you know, for a while there, all the chatter was about what happened to Frank's article, where did it go? And then when it was reposted with the explanation, the conversation was about how unfairly Newsweek had treated me. All of that was a distraction from the merits of my argument, which might be wrong and might be right, but you know, what we should be talking about is whether this thing called systemic racism really exists at all. And my argument is it really doesn't.
So what do the advocates of systemic racism mean when they use that term?
What they mean, well, I can quote you a kind of a definition. I guess it can be called a definition. Here, for instance, is a statement, not so much a definition, but a description of what racism is by a scholar named Umawale Akintunde. He's quoted by Robin DiAngelo in her recent, very prominent book, White Fragility. But Akintunde's quotation in DiAngelo's book dates from 1999. He says this, "Racism is a systemic, societal, institutional, omnipresent, and epistemologically embedded phenomenon that pervades every vestige of our reality." Now, I mean, you could hardly describe racism in more absolute terms than that, or universal terms than that. He's suggesting that it's just inextricably woven into the fabric of the life we lead in our society. It's in our culture, it's in our institutions. Presumably, it's in the hearts and minds of everybody in the country, I guess of every race, whether we wish it to be there or not, regardless of our own sentiments, regardless of our own opinions, regardless of our own choices about the actions we undertake. It's just there. I think this comes to us from something called critical race theory. Sometimes people speak of critical social justice theory, but it's a kind of a Marxist-derived way of looking at the world that sees everyone as either oppressors or oppressed. And it's not that anything you do makes you one of the oppressors or one of the oppressed. It's an identity thing. It's who you are. So white people in America, in the West generally, are just by definition in the oppressor class. People of color, blacks, indigenous peoples, are in the oppressed class, just by definition. And in a way, in certain academic fashions of this critical theory, there's even a rejection of the norms of reason, evidence, argument, and persuasion, logic itself even, are rejected as attributes of the liberal enlightened West, and as actually the tools of the oppressor class. So, I mean, it's a pretty neat trick when you think about it. If someone says that your argument is no good and uses the tools of logic, reason, and evidence to criticize your argument, a nice rebuttal is to say, well, the norms by which you're critiquing me are the oppressor's norms, right? What you've just done is stolen home plate. You've declared victory without having to make an argument, in fact, by denying that argument can possibly win. So I think that systemic racism comes out of these kinds of academic fads and fashions about oppressors and oppression, about the structures of the imperial West and its enlightenment values. And it's a far cry from the kind of serious conversation that ought to be had about racism, the real McCoy, the biases, the actions, the prejudices that people bear in their hearts and display in their actions toward people of other races.
I think when the average person hears the term systemic racism, he or she thinks of systematic racism. What's the difference, and why is that a mistake to hear systematic when systemic is being asserted?
Yeah, I think the difference is a key one, and it's not just semantics. I rely on the language scholar Brian Garner for this in my column. Garner's Modern English Usage, which is a very useful authority on the English language, he notes that there's a really substantial difference between systematic and systemic. In fact, he says that systemic is a term most useful in medicine. If you talk about the lymphatic system in the human body, if you have a systemic condition that affects the lymphatic system of your body, that's a sensible way to talk about disease or disorders in medicine. But if you want to talk about human action, which actually racism is a species of human thought and action, you need to instead to talk about the systematic. Systematic means a pattern of deliberate, intentional, or habitual behavior. So as I said in my article, you know, American chattel slavery was systematic. People, as individuals and through institutions, did bad things to other people systematically. They treated blacks as subhuman, as property. Jim Crow was systematic. Slaves, there were no more slaves. The blacks in America were now free, but they were oppressed under segregation, in inferior schools, in separate railroad cars, etc., water fountains, lunch counters, all segregated through the South. That was a systematic oppression, that is, deliberate, habitual, intentional, legalized, and institutionalized. I think that, you know, white supremacists and people who make a habit and pattern of targeting other races for ill treatment are behaving systematically. The claim about the systemic, interestingly enough, relieves the accuser of the system of the necessity of identifying any particular persons who have done particular actions, or of any institutional or legal systems, policies, for instance, that could be the explanations for disfavorable outcomes in minority groups. The systemic theorist simply, you know, announces without need of evidence, and indeed with all contrary evidence discounted, announces that the system produces all these outcomes. And he's off the hook for having to say who's done what.
We're talking with Dr. Matthew Frank, Associate Director of the James Madison Program and Lecturer in Politics at Princeton University, about systemic racism theory. He says it's actually a conspiracy theory. We'll find out how so next. Thanks to a generous donor, we've purchased a building for the new studios and offices of Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, and The Word of the Lord Endures Forever.
The donor will match up to $200,000 for the purchase and renovation.
The entire cost is approximately $375,000.
You can view an architect's rendering and make a special tax-deductible gift at issuesetc.org
or call 618-223-8385.
Thanks for your consideration.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
For your next family vacation, consider Our Beach House, a charming three-bedroom vacation rental on beautiful Siesta Key. Just off Sarasota, Florida, Siesta Key Beach, consistently voted America's best, is just 100 steps away. Whether you're watching the sunset over the Gulf of Mexico or frolicking in the warm surf, you and your family will fall in love with Siesta Key. Check us out at SiestaKeyRentalGenie.com or call Virginia at 941-266-1858.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It's been 6 years since Ad Crucem started advertising on Issues Etc., and we are so grateful for the support we have received from Pastor Wilkin and his team. In that time, we have increased our inventory substantially. We've added ornaments, church banners, jewelry, posters, and much, much more. But we still offer beautifully printed, theologically sound greeting cards that need no correction. So put away that Sharpie and come on over to adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
The Church's Music from the 20th Century. The 17th Century. The 11th Century. The 8th Century. The 4th Century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about systemic racism theory with Dr. Matthew Frank. He's Associate Director of the James Madison Program and Lecturer in Politics at Princeton University, contributing editor of Public Discourse, and author of a recent column titled Racism Is Real, But Is Systemic Racism? Dr. Frank, you say that systemic racism theory is actually a conspiracy theory. How so?
Well, it's a bit ironic, but I don't mean to be tongue-in-cheek or facetious about this. But conspiracy theories, whether it's QAnon or the Protocols of the Elders of Zion or what have you, or theories about Barack Obama's birth certificate or about who really brought the towers down on 9/11, conspiracy theories are generally marked by an imperviousness to evidence, that is, the lack of any evidence for what the theory purports to show is not counted against it, and contrary evidence, disproof, is always thrown out as manufactured or something believed only by the credulous or what have you. The other thing is that the deniers of the conspiracy theory are invariably regarded as arguing in bad faith or ignorantly naive, people who are either dupes or among the evil conspirators themselves. So in this respect, systemic racism theory fits perfectly. systemic racism theory is an unfalsifiable thesis. This has been remarked by intelligent reviewers of Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility, for instance, or Ibram Kendi's Stamp from the Beginning. They're unfalsifiable theories, lacking evidence and impervious to counter-evidence. And if you deny that there's systemic racism in this country, you're automatically suspected, as I found out, I knew this would happen, you're automatically suspected of being in on it yourself, or you know, someone who harbors racist thoughts or defends racism. Now, what differs about systemic racism theory compared to other conspiracy theories is that it, and in a way it makes it the perfect conspiracy theory, it doesn't need any conspirators. Usually conspiracy theories have some dark, shadowy figures at the back of everything, whether it's George Soros or the Jews or whatever. Conspiracy theories traffic in mysterious villains. There might be people who are suspected, and the conspiracy theory is trying to show that they're responsible for the evils that the theory is about, or they might just be unknown, but there's somebody. There's somebody back of this. In systemic racism theory, there's nobody. The whole society is suffused with this evil of racism, and nobody in particular is said to be responsible for anything. This makes it, in some ways, the most undisprovable of conspiracy theories, because you're never summoned to show who's responsible. His theory relieves him of the necessity of saying who's responsible.
I don't want to oversimplify, but does the idea of systemic racism assert, for instance, that merely being born white makes someone a party to an unwitting conspiracy to oppress non-whites?
That captures it pretty well. Yes. And so Robin DiAngelo's White Fragility book, I'll put it this way, it's a marketing tool for DiAngelo's consulting career of running anti-racism workshops, in which her purpose is to get all white people participating to declare their guilt regardless of anything they've ever done or said or thought.
I'm just trying to explore this a little bit hypothetically. So a white man who marries a African-American woman, they have children of mixed race, they love each other, they're faithful to one another, they respect one another, and yet still he remains the oppressor by virtue of his skin color and the accident of birth?
I think that would follow. I think that would follow. And, you know, as intermarriage has risen in our society, we see more and more such couples, and I don't know what the systemic racist theorists can possibly say to such people, except that maybe they're living some kind of lie in their marriage. I think the writer Thomas Chatterton Williams, who is himself of mixed parentage, one white parent, one black parent, has said something like this, that the thesis that American society is suffused with racism among all the whites is just refuted by his experience of his white parents. It just doesn't comport with reality.
But under systemic racism theory, it doesn't have to comport with reality, does it?
No. It's a theory impervious to reality. It creates its own reality.
So how do you account for the runaway success of books like the one you've mentioned here, White Fragility?
Well, look, to be as fair as possible to an argument I find fault with, it is the case that American society still has a lot of work to do to eradicate racism and to heal old wounds caused by four centuries of slavery, Jim Crow, and prejudice in this country. No one thinks that we've reached the promised land of perfect freedom from racism. And even if one thinks that, as I do, that we've made considerable progress in the last 55 or 56 years since the great Civil Rights and Voting Rights Acts of the mid-60s, nevertheless, there are still problems of white supremacy, of racism, individual racists in the criminal justice system, perhaps in other institutions. We, of course, there continue to be disparities in outcome across the races. Certain minority groups doing better, others doing worse, And people seek an explanation. Now racism is not necessarily the explanation of every disparity we see. No one should expect, I think, that if one observes the different races and ethnicities in America, that one should then be able to turn, say, to a university physics department and find that its demographic makeup is just like that of the larger society. That would be just a crazy expectation. And yet, when we observe that socioeconomic status, being subject to criminal punishment and so on, are phenomena with disparate outcomes in our society, many people leap immediately to the conclusion that only one thing can explain these disparities, and that's racism. So I think that systemic racism has some of the observable facts in American life on its side as an initial matter, if one simply doesn't examine them very closely for what might be their true causes. And the fact that we're not all pure of heart, and our problems have not all been solved, and the fact that some of our policies like affirmative action may even have exacerbated some of our racial difficulties in this country, all of this gives ammunition to the systemic racism theorist who I think, in effect, confesses intellectual failure, throws up his hands and says, only one thing can explain all these outstanding problems in American life, and that's the system, the man, the white man.
Where else is the idea of systemic racism being advanced in our society? You had mentioned corporate workshops, and I would call it maybe anti-racism training or something like that.
Yeah, anti-racism training modules are being forced on university faculty at some places. This has not happened at Princeton. I don't think it will happen at Princeton, but it has happened at other universities. I have a friend at a college in the South who came to the brink of losing his job over his refusal to engage in an anti-racism training program there. There's also the curricular progress, sadly, being made by the New York Times 1619 Project, which tells, frankly, a false history of the United States in order to urge on us the thesis that American society is shot through with racism in every particle of its being, and that the true founding of the United States was not 1776, when Thomas Jefferson and the Continental Congress declared that all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with unalienable rights. No, not then, but 1619, when a shipload of Africans sold into slavery was offloaded in Virginia. That's the true origins. It's as though one were to say that the mark of Cain was on American life, because the true origins of our culture were in the murder of Abel by his brother.
We're talking about systemic racism theory. Dr. Matthew Frank of Princeton University is our guest when we come back. If an institution, a corporation, a government agency adopts systemic race theory, what kind of policies are they likely to put into place?
How do we defend children's rights? Well, there's one very simple but hard answer to that, and it is that adults need to do hard things.
Katie Faust of Them Before Us, speaking at the 2020 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
Too often, we expect children to do the hard things in marriage and family situations. What about when adults are facing a struggling marriage? If the adults decide, we just can't work this out, what they're really saying is, this cross is too heavy for me. Here, kids, you take it instead.
You can watch and listen to a recording of Katie Faust's presentation, Making the Case for Children's Rights, from this year's Making the Case Conference. For a tax-deductible donation of $250, you can download an audio and video recording. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian, but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues Etc.
I'm afraid of death. Do I have enough faith to die? Will it be painful to die? What about deathbed conversions? Does God really forgive me if I've lived my whole life not as a Christian? These and many other questions are answered in the September issue of The Lutheran Witness, The Ars Moriendi, The Art of Dying Well. To subscribe, visit cph.org/witness. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective, cph.org/witness.
Did you know that many LCMS military personnel and their families are unable to receive Word and Sacrament ministry due to the lack of LCMS chaplains? Ministry to the Armed Forces is looking for pastors who will answer the call to serve as a chaplain to provide Word and Sacrament ministry to the men and women who selflessly serve our nation. Find out more about this exciting ministry by contacting me, Chaplain Craig Mueller, at lcmschaps@lcms.org. That is lcmschaps@lcms.org.
The substitute organist service has been a great blessing for our worship life here at Christ the King Lutheran in Riverview, Florida.
Pastor Kevin Yoakum on the substitute organist service.
Now our organ plays rich liturgical music every single Sunday, and it's very affordable. You pick the hymns, you pick the liturgies. It's very simple. Just know when to push play.
You can find out more about the substitute organist service at churchmusicsolutions.com, churchmusicsolutions.com.
We're discussing systemic racism theory with Dr. Matthew Frank of the Witherspoon Institute. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. Now, if you were unable to watch this year's Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference live, you can still watch it on demand or listen to a podcast. This year's speaking lineup included Matt Walsh, Mark and Molly Hemingway, Katie Faust, Chris Roseborough, Hans Feeney, and Greg Kokel. For a contribution of $250, we'll send you a video and audio link, a flash drive, or DVDs. Find out more at issuesetc.org/conference2020 or call 618-223-8385. Dr. Frank, if an institution or a corporation or a government agency were to adopt systemic race theory, what kind of policies are they likely to put into place?
Well, that's interesting. You know, it's not a necessary condition of affirmative action, for instance, that one buy into systemic racism theory. Affirmative action has been around a lot longer than systemic racism theory and continues to be practiced with more or less overt racial preference for so-called underrepresented groups in educational institutions and employment generally. So that's a policy that doesn't need systemic racism to keep going, and would presumably keep going if systemic racism died its well-deserved death as an idea. I think that the most notable feature of systemic racism theory is the adoption of what we discussed earlier, the anti-racism training that goes on and the kind of struggle sessions and group encounters in which people who've never done anything to particularly feel guilty about as racists are invited to affirm their guilt as part of a racist system. As I said in my article, you know, this is a hearts and minds approach that pointedly leaves out the minds and invites people to feel good about feeling guilty about vague sins they don't actually have to confess. So, I think that for the most part, what systemic racism theory achieves, not to be too cynical about it, is the career aspirations of people heavily invested in it and heavily invested in the kind of spoils system that systemic racism theory promises in the institutions that adopt it.
Why do the advocates of systemic racism theory avoid talking about individual or legal or even institutional racism?
It's easier to talk vaguely about the system, and that is to just observe the suffering of putative victims and attribute the suffering to the society. This relieves you a lot of hard work of gathering evidence and reasoning through matters of cause and effect. You've got a ready-made answer, so it's easy.
By way of solutions, it seems as though systemic racism theory is all diagnosis with very little remedy. What do the advocates of these ideas propose to reduce or eliminate systemic racism? Or can it be ever eliminated?
I don't know that they really promise to eliminate it so much as they wish to exploit it for advantage. This is a really great question. I'm thinking off the top of my head, but when I see the numbers of administrators in universities and HR personnel in corporations who are devoted to ensuring their institutions or their corporations' devotion to diversity, this is what I was referring to earlier when I mentioned the kind of spoil system that is at work. I think that the principal function of systemic racism is not to solve the problem it identifies, but to perpetuate the problem it identifies, because the work never ends for the people committed to it. After all, if a university's chief diversity officer ever really achieved his objective, really achieved it, so that the work of ensuring a diverse workplace had finished and needn't be attended to any longer because the hearts and minds having been changed, the diversity would thereafter be self-perpetuating without any monitor's attention, then the diversity officer would put himself out of business. But diversity officers don't want to put themselves out of business. They want to stay in business. So systemic racism is the handiest sort of problem. It exists by definition. It is ineradicable. And so those who are devoted to fighting it have lifetime work.
Does the prevalence of systemic racism theory, in your opinion, make it more or less difficult to route out and to deal with particular cases of legal, individual, or institutional racism?
Yeah, I think it does, because it's actually a huge diversion and distraction from the truly hard work of social scientists, prosecutors, government officials, people in employment and elsewhere, of figuring out how much of the disparity we see in our society can be chalked up to the ill will of racism, how much can be chalked up to blameless causes, what we can do about these disparities and what we can't do about them. And as I said in my article, one of the appalling things about systemic racism theory is that in tarring everyone in the oppressor class with the same brush of being a racist, it lets the actual racists among us off the hook. They're no worse than anybody else. And since these are people who actually do harbor racist thoughts, feelings, and act on them in their own lives, but actually they do believe in the superiority of their race, absurdly, they don't feel guilty. All the rest of us are invited to feel guilty about something we didn't do. Those who did do something are not induced to feel guilty. And any of us who aren't guilty of racism and stand up and say, listen, I'm not guilty, we're mistaken for actual racists, which does an injustice to us. So it's a huge diversion and distraction from the hard evidence-based work of real racial justice in our country.
Do you believe, since it has been at least the term, if not the theory itself, has been so quickly adopted by prominent people in our political life, do you believe that this theory is a permanent feature of American political life for the time being?
For the time being. Well, I hope it's a short time. I'm optimistic enough to believe that truly bad and indefensible intellectual constructs collapse under their own weight in due course. So I look forward to that fate awaiting systemic racism theory. But who knows? This could take 20 years. Other crazes and manias afflict our society now. I think prominently, for instance, of transgenderism, especially among young girls today. I look forward to those trends and those crazes collapsing because they harm people. And I think systemic racism will find its way out. The sooner the better.
Finally, then, Dr. Frank, in a nutshell, why is systemic racism theory a false construct?
Well, it's a false construct because it simply flies in the face of what each of us actually knows, which is that racism, while very real and something to be guarded against in our own hearts and our own actions, because we are fallen creatures prone to be sinners, nevertheless, systemic racism just doesn't comport with what each of us knows as we look around at our friends, our neighbors, reflect on ourselves. It's not supported by evidence. It effectively claims to be impervious to counter evidence. It fails in the first duty of any accusation with moral weight, and that is it fails to identify actors responsible for the immorality it purports to describe. And it's a kind of perpetual motion machine, an unfalsifiable theory that just motors along because it has the capacity to make some people feel good about its explanation of the reality we live in.
Dr. Matthew Frank is Associate Director of the James Madison Program and Lecturer in Politics at Princeton University, Senior Fellow at the Witherspoon Institute. He's Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Radford University, Contributing Editor to Public Discourse, and author of a recent column titled Racism Is Real, But Is Systemic Racism? You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Dr. Frank, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll continue our series, The Words of Scripture, talking about righteousness in the first five books of the Bible. Our guest will be Pastor Will Wheaton, host of the daily 15-minute verse-by-verse Bible study, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever. We'll also play Issues Etc. Soundbite of the Week. Listen and vote in advance at facebook.com/issuesetc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hey, Todd, what have our listeners noticed first when visiting the LPR studios?
Definitely the small size and the dirt.
Well, not anymore. Thanks to our friends at the Cleaning Authority, they've turned this man cave into a space that meets even our wives' approval.
Whether it's our office or your home, the Cleaning Authority is your cleaning service provider in the St. Louis area.
To schedule a free estimate or to find out more, visit thecleaningauthority.com. thecleaningauthority.com.
The grace of God, the church's music, the Lord's Supper every service every Sunday, preaching Christ crucified and risen, our hope for years to come. There is hope in St. Louis, Hope Lutheran Church, that is. 5218 Neosho Street, St. Louis, Missouri. Find us on the web at hopelutheranstl.org.
Bahama Mama, Ocean Pacific, Paradise Island. Retreat from the heat with a shaved ice snow cone from Tropical Snow in Caseyville, Illinois. It's right across the street from Collinsville High School. Tropical Snow is open weekdays from 1 to 9 and weekends from noon to 9. Premium snow, epic flavors, lots of love. Tropical Snow across the street from Collinsville High School at 2134 South Morrison Avenue in Caseyville.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.
Do you dread going to work out? Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.